Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, comics, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome again to the Rising from the Ashes edition of Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden, and today we welcome actor Timothy McLaughlin to Foul Players Radio. He's an actor who's appeared on Monk, CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, Everybody Hates Chris, From the Earth to the Moon, just to name a few, had an uncredited part as Jackie Earle Haley's body double in Nightmare on Elm Street. He has lots of great stories about his career from his days in theater to television and movies, discussing his favorite childhood desserts with Alfred Molina on the set of Monk, and reading for Tom Hanks on the set of From the Earth to the Moon. And as of the date of the release of this episode, according to his IMDb page, it is also his birthday. So let's wish Timothy a wonderful and happy birthday. Subscribe for free at www.foulplayersradio.com or listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, Overcast, Castro, Castbox, or Podfriend. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. The Foul Players of Perryville are now booking murder mystery shows for the late summer and fall of 2021. We do indoor or outdoor venues, trains, boats, office parties, fundraisers, galas, whatever you got, just for the heck of it. Give us a call, 443-600-0446, or you can find us at www.foulplayersofperryville.com or foulplayersperryville@yahoo.com if you'd like to email us. We hope to hear from you. We'll be back with Timothy McLaughlin right after these words.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Christopher Stolle of Breaking the Fourth Wall. If you enjoy our show, you can find it on YouTube. Just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment, or just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment on Anchor.fm, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, or wherever quality podcasts can be heard. And also, you can find us on all the social medias. Just look for Realm of the Mist Entertainment, and I will catch you on the other side.
I'm Michael, the host of the semi-monthly podcast, In a City Like Yours. Join me as I chat with interesting people with interesting life stories. You can listen to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Twitter at IACLYS Podcast, as well as on Facebook and Instagram at In a City Like Yours Podcast. Please feel free to let me know what you think, and keep coming back for the many interesting stories in a city like yours.
Hey, this is Don Smith from the Life Radio Show. If you've always wanted to learn more about the world of low-budget filmmaking and even lower-budget comedy, tune into the Life Radio Show. You can live stream the show at WWSU1069.org on Tuesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, or find us wherever you find podcasts and like and follow the Life Radio Show on Facebook for live video and other shenanigans.
Hey, what's up? This is Christopher Stolle of Realm of the Mist Entertainment. The podcast you are listening to is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com. That's s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and information on those shows, as well as information and an ability to contact publicist Steve Joyner for more information. Just go to the website and check out the family. Ladies and gentlemen, until then, enjoy the show.
So, Timothy McLaughlin, I'm happy to have you here on Foul Players Radio. I've heard a lot about you, and we've been talking a little bit. And welcome to the show.
Hey, man. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Right. So we were talking a little bit, me being from Baltimore, as you can tell, and you grew up, actually, your first couple of years, you lived in Washington, not too far away, quite a football rivalry back in those days, you know, with back when it was the Colts and the team were no longer allowed to say.
I'm going to say it because I'm a Redskins fan from the moment I was born.
Right.
So that's kind of hard to get out of your blood.
It is.
Tough.
Right. So, so you lived down there for a little bit, you know, and I know DC pretty well, having performed there quite a bit, doing theater and music down there. It was a great place to play music, just hell to get in and out of. Back in the days before GPS, it was a heck of a place. But so this acting bug, from what you're telling me, you hit you at a young age and you started off, doing this as a youngster, and you've kind of been with it for a long time. So tell us about that.
Yeah. My first experience with it was when I was a kid. I think it was fourth or fifth grade. Mm-hmm. My teacher came up to me and she asked me if I wanted to do a solo in the Christmas play. It was a song. I grew up in a Catholic high school. Catholic schools all the way up through high school. Mm-hmm. And so she asked me to do that. And for my first time up on stage, it was a rush. It was an adrenaline rush, even as, you know, was it like a 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid. So it went over really well. The audience loved me. And, you know, I just kind of, you know, you grow up, you do your things, you know, Little League, and you just mess around as a kid and you do your thing. And then when I got to high school, I joined the drama club my junior year in high school, mm-hmm. because I had the hots for some really good looking high school girl. Mm-hmm. And of course, yeah, that kind of got me involved in that. And then it just snowballed. I started enjoying it more and more and more. And from there, it moved on into college, where I majored in theater at the University of Florida.
Oh, okay.
And got my fine arts degree there. Then down to Orlando, where the Universal Studios was opening up at the time. And I got on there and I started doing all their stage shows for the next 9 years.
Nice. So,
one of my favorite shows was the Ghostbuster show. I got cast as the Rick Moranis character, the nerdy Louis Tully account at the Ghostbuster.
Is that right?
Idea. Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Is that right? That's really cool. That's really cool that you did that. And, and I'm glad, you know, because I think with you telling me about you being 9 years old, being given a solo like that in front of everybody, that could have either broken you and been the cause for years and years of therapy. Yeah. Or if it went well, led to this, you know, which is really cool. But, these live shows, these live action shows, I mean, you know, Burt Reynolds used to do those years and years ago. And that's actually where he met the two guys from Deliverance, I think, doing those live shows like in a amusement park or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was, it wasn't a SeaWorld. It was like it was called Ocean World or something. It was down on the East Coast.
Yeah.
By Jupiter, where he was from.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think he got involved with one of those live shows there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was like a frontier town type of thing, or like an old, like a ghost town sheriff.
And yeah.
The guy shoot out at high noon or something. Something.
Yeah. Like, yeah. They had something. They had something. I don't know the specifics. I can't put my finger on it exactly. It was so long ago. Mm-hmm. God, I mean, I was a little kid when that was happening, but I do remember hearing something about that. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I did do two or three shows down there at Universal, the Ghostbuster show. And then when the Ghostbuster show closed, I went over and I started doing this new show called the Hercules and Xena show, which was a lot of fun. And I got to play a lot of different characters there. Mm-hmm. And then they had a show called the Gory, Gruesome and Grotesque Horror Makeup Show. So I did some shows over there as well. And I even did a kid's show called the Barney Show. When that was happening. So that was a lot of fun to do.
That's great. That's awesome. I would love to do shows like something like that, where, you know, I guess this wasn't probably a traditional stage show, was it? Were they more like interactive, where people were, where you were walking amongst the people, or were you actually on stage doing these, like the Ghostbusters?
No, I was on stage. They were scripted shows.
Oh, they were. Okay.
Yeah. And then afterwards we got to meet up with the guests and sign mm-hmm. autographs and take pictures and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And believe me, you look back on it and you go, wow, that was a really fun time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're 25, 28 years old and you're doing these shows, six shows a day, it kind of grinded on you after a while. Yeah. But it was a fantastic job. I mean, it was grueling, physically grueling. Mm-hmm. But at the same token, you know, you're a young kid and, you know, mm-hmm. God knows what else you could be doing instead of this great stuff. So, mm-hmm. yeah, had a good time. And it definitely trained me. Mm-hmm. You know, it trained me in my acting profession.
Right. Well, that's boot camp for you right there. Really. That's where you pay your dues and you're able to get out and perform. And once you get through something like that, you're used to it. And there's really nothing that can stop you once you get past that point. You know, my wife actually, and you were just speaking of, you know, Jupiter. My wife was a performer at the Jupiter Theater for, I think, a year and a half. And yeah. When Reynolds owned it, actually, and yep. got to do everything. I think they were doing, gosh, I think 8 shows a week plus children's theater plus, and it was very, very intense. The program was where they actually got to learn not only acting, but, you know, backstage managing, lights, sound, cues, props, everything was done. And then they all acted and everything. Yeah. And it was just like a nonstop thing. And, what an experience. I wish I could have had an experience like that.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal. The Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater, man, that was a good time down there. I had many friends that were in Universal Studios that did shows over there too. Mm-hmm. So there may be a connection, with, friends that your wife knew and friends that I knew. So,
oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that was just, you know, I mean, just welcome to the pros. You know, all the stories she told me about the people she got to perform with and everything she learned down there was just worth its weight in gold. And yeah, having those experiences like that, even have you ever done any repertoire or repertory theater?
I mean, in college, I did some rep mm-hmm. over the summers, you know, between semesters. There was the Hippodrome was the repertory theater in Gainesville.
Oh, sure.
So I was, I've auditioned for a few shows there and was involved with a lot of things that were going on there. And mm-hmm. Out here in California, I did a couple of shows with the Santa Clarita Repertory Theater when we lived up there in Santa Clarita. Mm-hmm. I did a couple of shows there. So, yeah.
Well, interesting. What shows did you do? Because that could be a pretty intense schedule.
Yeah, I did Neil Simon's Rumors.
Oh, okay.
Which was a great comedy. And then we switched it up over the summer and I did some Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing. And what was the other one I did? Trying to remember. It was a while ago. Much Ado About Nothing and Twelfth Night.
Oh, what did you play in Twelfth Night?
I played Sea Captain.
I was the captain.
I did. I played
4615 Theater. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Great. And it was funny because at that time, the director looked at me when I auditioned and said, "Can you grow a beard?" And I said, "I'll have one for you in 2 weeks." And there was. Yeah. She was all happy about that.
Exactly the part I grew my beard for. Wow. Yeah. Awesome. Tis Illyria. Yeah. For I was born and bred not 3 hours from here or something like that. God.
Oh, God. Yeah.
What a great show.
I have lost my Shakespeare touch. I probably would get back into it now if there was an opportunity, but yeah, COVID is so crazy right now. There's nothing, you know, it's terrible. I do. A friend of mine is down in not Shakespeare Festival. He's the Orlando Auditorium of the Civic Theater. Mm-hmm. He's doing a run with Driving Miss Daisy.
Driving Miss Daisy. Actually, my wife, they did that at Jupiter. And Ted Lang played the
No kidding. Like
the Morgan Freeman part.
Yeah.
He's going to be a guest on my show coming up too.
Excellent. Tell him I said hi. Tell him I loved watching him growing up. Loved mm-hmm. watching him on the Love Boat. It was a fun show.
Oh yeah.
Loved much. But that's awesome. That's awesome.
It is. And the thing is with Shakespeare, you know, getting back to that, I'd done it a couple of times. I did Othello, Twelfth Night. And then have you ever heard of, it was John Ford, Tis Pity She's a Whore. That was a 15th century. It was written around the same time. He was a contemporary of Shakespeare.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I tell you what, we did that repertory one summer. And I tell you what, that was probably the biggest boot camp experience I ever had, but I felt so yes, you know, after I finished it, you know, I did that with a group of kids, I shouldn't call them kids because they took me to school. They were graduates of the Ithaca College.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
Oh, I tell you what, welcome to the pros, my friend. Welcome to the pros. And I tell you what, that was something else right there. But,
Ithaca. Yeah. They're really well trained up there.
Jesus. Man, I tell you, that was, I tell you what, those kids, I shouldn't say kids because, I'm old enough. I was well old enough to be their father. You know, that's why.
Then you've earned the right to call them kids just on that basis, Mike.
Okay. <All right>? Okay. But I tell you what, those young people were kick ass.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen anybody like these kids or people. Young people, you know, it was just an amazing experience, you know. So how about, and you know, doing the Ghostbusters thing, you know, I'd done quite a bit of children's theater shows for kids over the years. Isn't that fun?
The Ghostbuster show was a lot of fun. The one more to the kids was the live Barney show.
Oh yeah, sure.
I got to play back then in the 90s, you know, Barney was, you know, he was the thing. Mm-hmm. And I played a character that was specifically written for that live stage show called Mr. Peekaboo. And he was the only facial character. Everyone else had the hat or the costumes. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't see their faces and everything was sort of voiced over. You know, you had the Barney, the other characters. But Mr. Peekaboo was a face character. So I had a microphone. And so I had to see, you saw my voice and my mouth and everything like that. So it was a fun character where he was like a nutty professor. So this kind of wacky, you know, crazy guy who's, you know, so it was a lot of fun. And the kids, you know, you just lights them up, you know, these mm-hmm. kids just, you know, little 3, 2, 4 year olds standing around jumping and clapping. I mean, they're not looking at me. I mean, they're looking at Barney and his character buddies.
Right.
But
right.
It was so much fun seeing all the energy of these kids and just, you know, now they're all grown up and they're in their 30s and
sure.
Now, yeah. But great show. It was a great show.
The theater that I came up with in Maryland, the Baltimore Actors Theater, did a lot of children's shows in the summertime. They would come out during the day and I would, you know, take off from my job usually on Wednesday mornings, and they would come out and we would do things like Little Red Riding Hood and just like the standard fairy tale stuff.
Yeah.
And these kids absolutely loved it. And we did Babes in Toyland every Christmas, and just watching these kids, cause they, when you talk about the suspension of disbelief, these kids really suspend that disbelief with these kids, you know?
I wish that they could get back to that. I mean, get these mm-hmm. kids out from in front of their computers, get them out away from their video games and their electronic mm-hmm. devices and, you know, get them out into some open air theater, mm-hmm. you know, where they could just be kids, you know,
right.
And have a good time. And yeah, I do miss that. I hope we can get back to that someday. And mm-hmm. you know what? I think it's going to make a revival. I think after this pandemic starts to wind down and people mm-hmm. start coming out and spreading out and, you know, start enjoying a little more of the outdoors and interacting more with everybody, I think you're going to see a revival of it because everybody is going to be, you know, they're all going to be so pent up and they're going to be looking mm-hmm. to get back to that normalcy. So mm-hmm. I think it could definitely make a comeback in the next year or two.
I think, and the thing is too, with people being so locked up, I really haven't played video games since I was a kid, but I do have a couple of little things on my phone that I kill time with, you know?
Yeah.
But after a while they get old, you know, and I can imagine if somebody's really been cooped up a lot and that's been their only outlet. I just have a feeling that you're right. I agree that we are going to come back to that. People being tired of, you know, just video games and having everything, having your imagination decided for you and using your own imagination. Do you know what you follow what I meant? See what I mean by that? Like, instead of having these pre-made video games, you know, using your own imagination to come up
and
with
just
things.
Just getting out and running around too, Mike. I mean, getting out
physical
running around, you know, climbing a jungle gym set or, you know, swinging on the swings and playing frisbee or, you know, stuff like that. Just getting out and, you know, feeling freedom in that aspect. You know, just that freedom.
Getting dirty.
Because it's been tough. I mean, these kids have been, you know, they've been cooped up and they've been stuck on, what do you call it? Skype sessions, just like you and I here, but they've been stuck on it with school. And a lot of these kids are suffering from interaction with their friends.
I couldn't imagine A, going to school like that, and B, teaching like that.
Exactly.
It's got to be brutal on both ends. That's got to be brutal on both ends. You know, it's just too much. And you know, I taught college for a while, and I couldn't imagine. I like to be there with people, and I like to be able to explain things and show them things and be there firsthand. Just, you know, doing it like this is, you know, doing it like that is, it just doesn't cut it. It really just doesn't cut it. And you know, so
it's that physical, interaction that is necessary for human contact is necessary. Without it, people wouldn't survive.
They really wouldn't. So, you've got some, you were telling me about some projects, that are new for you. Tell us what's been going on. I see some recent on your credits here on your IMDb page. I was looking through that and I see some stuff that's been coming out in recent years here. So you've got some recent credits. Exciting projects coming out.
Gosh, yeah, you're trying to do anything. I mean, I took a break for a couple of years. I actually coached my son's high school golf team.
Oh, wow.
So I decided, you know, and, you know, when your kids are at that high school age, they need a little more attention. They need to be guided a little more. They need you know, you can't sit there and they can't be latchkey kids at that age. There's too many variables out there that can happen. So I took a few years off from acting. And then when my son graduated high school back in 2019, my wife and I moved down here to Dana Point and I said, let's get going. Let's, you know, so I had some acting projects that I had done at the end of in the fall of 2019 and they went into post-production and then COVID hit. So, one of them is wrapped up and is going to probably get entered into some festivals. It's a short film, but it's a really great comedy and it's called Fleeced. And I play a farmer from Idaho who wins the lottery and then all kinds of craziness ensues. So, it's kind of along the lines of, if you know, Rowan Atkins, Mr. Bean character. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine if he was a farmer up in Idaho. And he won so that's the short film. It's a really great comedy. And
love it.
I can't wait for it to get out to the festivals. We're looking forward to it. Another project that I did was called The King of Wishful Thinking, which is going to probably find a more difficult path before it gets out into the screen. You never know what happens when you're doing it. So many films are made and they never see the screen. They never see people never get to see it because of any and everything that can possibly happen after you've done filming it. And what happened with us was we had some tragedy. The director, there was some tragic events that occurred after the filming and it's still been stuck in post-production and there's legal issues and trying to get the project to the right post-production facility and who's in charge of it because you know, when a film gets made, it's supposed to be registered under a production company or an LLC, you know, and so now there's some legal battles going on to try to get that film finished. Mm-hmm. And it's about a 45-minute film, so it's not really a full length and it's not really a short, but it was slated to make some big festivals. I mean, it was going to go, you know, we were hoping to get it into some really big international film festivals.
Well, good.
But
well,
we're going to have to wait.
Let's hope it happens, you know.
Yeah.
And what would you like after these festivals, what would your plans be? What would the plans be for distribution? I guess you would have to, kind of prove yourselves. And I guess if you're successful at these festivals and get good reviews, then you would probably draw the interest of a distribution company or a Netflix or an HBO or television or whatever.
Yeah. As far as short films go, there's not really a spot for that. But there are some streaming sites that will pick up these short films and they'll play like an evening of comedy shorts, or they'll play, and it'll be a streaming platform. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but yeah, most feature films that go through the festivals they go there specifically with the hopes of being picked up by like Lionsgate, you know, or another big distributor so that they can get it out on video, or they can get it seen maybe in some theaters locally, or, you know, get it on a number of screens. But this whole last year has been a reinvention year for me. When the pandemic hit, I sat down and said, this is a perfect opportunity to change my entire look, to change my entire everything. Because I'm always trying to create new characters, because I'm always trying to appeal to casting directors for different roles. I mean, I've done so many different roles and so many different characters. And now I'm trying to push myself into that Westerner, you know, like Yellowstone or even a Sons of Anarchy type of a show.
Or even
like an Outlander show, a period piece, you know, that takes you back to the Scottish Highlands, you know, something along those lines. I'm trying to push myself into that genre. And so hence the beard and mustache and the facial hair have come out with that intent. So, this new year, I mean, is a whole new year for me to create a new character, a new persona to attract, you know, attract new agents, new casting directors too.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you, because I've spent a lot of time back at the drawing board myself this year, working on things for my murder mystery company, and I really think from everybody I've interviewed this year and everybody I've gotten to know, you know, we've been on, this has been kind of the drawing board year involuntarily, you know, but I have a feeling we're going to go through a new renaissance once we're able to get back out there. I think there's going to be a lot of content, a lot of material. There are going to be a lot of projects, and people are just going to come, and not only will there be the creative end of it with people willing to, you know, people wanting to get out and make these things, there's going to be a lot of demand, because people that are, you know, just observers or fans of, you know, movies and plays and that kind of thing are going to want to get out and see something after having been cooped up watching Amazon Prime and Netflix for the past year.
Well, I mean, remember this, they went 6 months without filming a single thing.
Yeah.
So, so that's a big gap that's got to be made up. Mm-hmm. And this coming year, they're starving for new content.
Right.
I believe Yellowstone just is doing a spinoff this year called, Yellowstone, the beginning, but it's Yellowstone 1883.
It's where
it all began. It's where the Dutton family, you know, started owning the land out there, or how it came to be. It's obviously going to be a period piece in the 1800s. I'd love to get on that show. That would be a great show to do.
Oh, it sounds like it. Yeah.
But again, all these new contents, I mean, they're killing themselves trying to get this stuff out. I mean, I think Stranger Things has got a new season, and, and they've been trying to work on that. And then you got Cobra Kai, which was another great show.
Yep.
You know, that's a lot of popularity going on with that. So,
right.
Yeah, they're playing catch up, Mike. And
Mrs. Maisel too.
Oh, I love that show.
Oh, isn't that show great?
I love that show.
That show great.
Season one or two? Was it two or one season? It's two seasons, I think.
I think it's two right now, yeah. And I think they're working on three.
Yeah, and
I think they've been signed to do another one. I think that I think there are plans to do four.
Yeah,
and then
love Tony Shalhoub. Tony Shalhoub I didn't work with him in particularly on the episode of Monk that I did. Mm-hmm. I got to work with Alfred Molina, who was another fantastic.
Oh, yes.
He was great. Loved working with Alfred.
Oh, he's an awesome actor. Tell me about that.
Oh, humble. One of the humblest guys you've ever wanted to meet. Mm-hmm. Just happy to have regular conversation with you. We were in between takes and we were sitting in the limousine. Mm-hmm. Cause I played his lawyer, his attorney in the episode. And so we're sitting in the limousine and we're talking about, the kinds of, desserts that our grandmothers would make for us when we were kids, and we were just talking about all these great things about growing up and being a kid, and then I turned around and I asked him, I said, so what are you doing after this? And his answer was incredible. I mean, he sit there and he says, I'm doing the same thing you're doing. I'm looking for another job. Mm-hmm. He said, and it was so kind of him to say something like that. But I mean, I know he had things lined up, mm-hmm. right after the next, but still he is humble enough to admit or to accept and understand that acting is a part-time job. And it mm-hmm. is something that is not guaranteed from one job to the next.
No,
and so, yeah. So his explanation is he approaches every single job as if it's his last job he's ever going to have. Mm-hmm. And what a great, insightful little nugget for him to say to me. It was really good and mm-hmm. made me feel basically in that same pool that he's in. And we're all actors.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've experienced the same thing myself on Gotham and Kimmy Schmidt. And even in the ID Discovery shows and things like that, that I've done, I've told these stories about how everybody was just such regular people. Yep. And they were very kind. When I first got to these sets, I mean, they rolled out the red carpet and they were just very kind and welcoming. Yep. And, there are so many people you hear about divas and you hear about prima donnas and people that are jerks, but I haven't experienced that with anybody yet. And, I think I've been very blessed. And even before the bigger things that I've done, like the network stuff, the local things I've done here in Maryland, I've been very, very blessed to have the people I've had too. It's just, it's really a wonderful thing when you get to work with good people,
Yeah. I mean, you're going to have great actors, humble, you're going to have difficult actors. There are. And it's not to say that they're not bad actors. They may be, they may be dealing with personal issues that they're bringing on the set. And it just may be difficult to work with them. There's been a few here or there, but nothing that I can actually sit there and say, wow, I'd never work with that person ever again. Mm-hmm. I got to sit down with Tom Hanks when I was filming From the Earth to the Moon.
Is that
one of my first ever projects? Yeah. Yeah. I filmed one of the episodes about a week or two later, my agent called me up and said, Tom Hanks wanted to see me. And my first impression was, oh God, what did I do to mess up their miniseries now? He called me in and he wanted to read me for some of the other episodes. He wanted to put me in to some of the other episodes. Mm-hmm. And I literally got to sit down and read script with him. That was like right at the beginning of my career. That was back in 1998, I think it was.
Yeah. That was around the time that was out. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it was an amazing experience. And he, again, I walked in there, how you doing, Mr. Hey? And he was just very inviting. He goes, hey, Tim, how you doing? Come on in, man. Mm-hmm. How you been? And all of a sudden I was like, I'm great. Hey, awesome, dude. How you doing? So very nice guy. One of the nicest human beings that I've ever come across in the industry. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's just an awesome story right there, because I mean, he's the top of the heap when it comes to,
Oh yeah. Yeah. Two-time Academy Awards.
Oh, easily. And nominated for a whole bunch. And, you know, and then all the projects and things that he's been involved in over the years. I mean, he's definitely a, he's definitely one of the top dogs ever, really.
Yeah, he is. He's a, he's an A plus list guy. Yeah. So, but again, he acts as humble as can be. Mm-hmm. And he treats you literally like you're on the same level. And that's just an amazing feeling to be able to work with people like that, feel comfortable. I mean, another great guy I worked with was Ed Begley Jr.
Oh, wow. How was that?
That was a lot of fun. I did a film with him. It was one of my first projects as well, called The Lay of the Land. And I had a great scene with him. And he was just regular guy, mm-hmm. you know? And I think it was like about 4 years later, I bumped into him at Universal Studios out in California here. And mm-hmm. I was just walking through the Universal City Walk, and he was having lunch with, I don't know whether it was his manager or agent, over at Wolfgang Puck's. And I stopped and I saw him and I said, "Hey, how you doing?" And he looked at me, he goes, "Tim," he says, "come on over here, sit down." So I sat down and chatted with him for a few minutes, but great guy. Great, great guy. Same thing. Bumped into Tom Hanks about 8 years after I did From the Earth to the Moon, when I was on the Paramount lot filming Everybody Hates Chris.
Oh, and sure.
I came out of my trailer, and I look across, and out of the soundstage across from my trailer walks Philip Seymour Hoffman, Julia Roberts, and Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. And they were all doing a reading of Charlie Wilson's War.
Oh, right.
And
right.
Philip and Julia, they kind of went off in their own separate direction. And then Tom came straight across to a craft service table that was right by my trailer. And I said, "Hey, Tom, how you doing?" And he looked up and he comes over, he shakes my hand. He goes, I know you. And then when I told him, he was like, "Yeah, that's it. That was great. How you doing? What are you doing here on the back lot? Oh, wow. You're over there. Great." Mm-hmm. You know, and it was just a conversation, like a regular, like my next door neighbor. That's, mm-hmm. It was like he was my next door neighbor. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, the really good people in the industry don't forget you when you work on a project.
They really don't. No. I had that experience on Gotham. You know, one of the fellas I worked with, the guy who killed me actually on the show, he was actually a guest on this podcast, and we've been in touch ever since then. And he's just a great guy, just a great guy. You know, Andrew Schellen was his name. He played Mr. Penn, and he killed
him. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's great to die on set. That's one of my favorite things to do. I love dying on camera. It's just awesome because there's so many ways to die. Mm-hmm. And I did that one time on a TV series called Mortal Kombat, which was a TV series back in the 90s as well.
Yeah.
And I got to die on camera. I loved it. It was great.
You know, something that's always fascinated me is special effects, prosthetics, and the way they're able to make gore. I've been a haunt actor too. And there's been some folks that work with these haunts that are able to make, you know, severed arms look realistic and heads and blood. And when I was on Gotham, and you could tell we were getting towards the end of the series.
Yeah.
Because I only died once. Because I was one and done for me. Everybody else got to die and come back about four times, it seemed like.
Yeah. Yours was pretty definitive, huh?
Right. But it was just a gunshot wound, but then they had me laying on the floor and they had blood all around me and blood coming out of my mouth. And I was just kind of laying there and they just kept talking, you know, after I was shot dead, I was just laying there. And, but how they did all these things was just fascinating. I was talking to the special effects people without getting in the way. And you really learn a lot, don't you?
Oh, you do. You do. And I don't know. It's not on my IMDb credit. But I was Jackie Earle Haley's double in the last Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Well, tell me about that
it was a great experience. I mean, mm-hmm. I did all the second unit work, basically mm-hmm. everything that wasn't Jackie Earle Haley and Freddy Krueger's face mm-hmm. was me. I mean, all the moves with the knife and the hand and the walking from behind and over the shoulder shots where you saw Freddy's POV. It was all me. So,
okay.
It was great. It was a great experience because I didn't have to memorize any lines. I just had to, do stage direction, and it involved a lot of special effects, a lot of blood. You know, I was stabbing through prosthetic torsos, you know, like I was killing the victims, those close-up shots of Freddy, you know, slashing his victims and blood flying everywhere. Those were all me and the second unit crew doing all that stuff. So that was a blast. I mean, and another humble guy, Jackie, what a nice guy. I mean, the guy just, and boy, you talk about somebody that worked hard.
Mm-hmm.
Filming that movie was difficult. He was exhausted at the end of that film.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. Well,
how long did it take to make you up for that? I mean, I'm sure with Freddy Krueger, that looks like a pretty complex.
I didn't have to wear any of the prosthetic face.
Oh, okay.
And no, because no, I it, everything that anytime that face was shown, it was Jackie.
Okay.
So you never saw my face at all at any time. I mean, I wore the hat. Mm-hmm. And I had the knife hands and the shirt and the pants and everything. So, you know, I was dressed up like him in every way except for the face. And yeah, the mask for him, yeah, it took a couple hours. It was one of those pullover tight masks that went on really close to his skin. And that was, yeah, I think he was in his makeup chair for at least two and a half hours before he went on set, if not
gosh. More. Yeah. I couldn't even imagine having to do that. And then could you imagine they get all that stuff on you and everything, then it itches.
Oh yeah. All the stuff he had to do. Yeah. No, he was, and I think that's why he was so exhausted. I could be wrong, but I mean, you know, at the end of the day, he just had this, oh boy, I just want to go home and go to sleep.
Absolutely.
And it was very physically demanding too. You know, he's just, there's so many scenes there that were fighting and, you know, it was a lot of physical activity in the scenes. So, and Rooney Mara was in it and she was great. Mm-hmm. She was great. I didn't talk a whole lot with her because she just kind of kept to herself. And, you know, when you're doing that kind of a character, you know, you need to stay focused. And that's really where both of them were most of the time. But
okay.
Yeah, I had my moments. It was fun with him. It really was.
Yeah, I always liked Jackie Earl Haley. He from the Bad News Bears, and then another movie I liked. It was one of those 80s cable TV classics called Losing It with Tom Cruise. He was that guy. He thought he was Frank Sinatra. He was almost like a nerd, you know. And he were going down to Mexico to get his seats stuffed. They put horse crap in his seats and everything. Yeah.
You know, it was those period pieces of coming of age and, you know, those kinds of films were, you know, today they've got similar ones. They're, you know, they're what were the dance challenge ones or the sing challenging ones? Well, I can't remember the names of those, but I mean, all of these kid ones nowadays, they're every generation. Yeah.
Bring it on.
Yep.
That was like a cheerleading competition one or something, right?
Yeah. And then there's they made like three of them, like sing off ones, the ones where they had the singing competitions with, what was the British gal, hysterical comedian, I'm trying to remember her name. I'm so bad. Now, see, this is what happens when you get old.
I know.
I used to be able to pull everything right off the top of my head.
Me now too.
It's just now foggy. But they did like three Pitch Perfect. There you go.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Pitch Perfect. That's the three or four movies they did there, those kids type of movies. And hey, it's all good. You know, every generation has their, but I mean, you cannot discount the John Hughes classics.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely not.
My kids were watching them and love. My kids are watching them. Oh my God, Dad, these are great. I go, that's what we grew up on. Weird Science, 16 Candles. You know, these are the great movies of our time where they were just nonsensical, you know, teenage high school buffoonery kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
You know?
Oh yeah, so many of them. There were, you know, 16 Candles. You've met 16 Candles, Weird Science, and then Pretty in Pink.
Yep.
Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club. I mean, even movies like The Goonies and the, you know, the Outsiders, you know, just great, great classic 80s movies that were, and even, what do you call it? With the Tom Cruise, when he plays the football player. Oh God. He played the high school football player.
Lucas.
That was a good movie though, but
that was Charlie Sheen. That was Charlie Sheen as the football star. That was Corey Haim.
Corey Haim. Yep. Those movies there. But the one that I bet your listeners would be like, it's so easy. Like I said, it'll click after about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But then, I mean, Cruise did all of these, that Risky Business. Mm-hmm. These movies just, they're timeless.
Oh yeah. You know? One Crazy Summer and Better Off Dead, John Cusack.
Oh yeah. Oh, High Fidelity.
High Fidelity. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
That was another great one. Love that one.
Oh, you can quote these things forever too. And then of course there were the great John Candy movies, Armed and Dangerous, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. This
Midnight Run is one of my favorite movies.
Yes,
Charles Grodin and De Niro.
Yes,
one of my favorite comedies, Midnight Run. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, where like I'd say half of the iconic actors made their debuts. Fast Time at Ridgemont High.
Yes. You know? Fast Time.
So many famous actors that came out of that. Judge Reinhold, you know, and of course Sean Penn.
Yep, Eric Stoltz.
Yep, Eric Stoltz. I mean, there were half a dozen guys, did you know that freaking Nicolas Cage was in that?
Yes. He was in that, and he was also in Valley Girl.
That was his big starring role. But he had like a bit role. He was like he played Spicoli's, you know, a pot buddy or whatever it was, you know.
And Nicolas Cage and I think Eric Stoltz was the
other. Eric Stoltz and Nick Cage were his two buddies.
Yeah.
And how about this one? Forrest Whitaker.
Yes. Forrest Whitaker. He was the one they trashed his car and he went.
Yep. He was the football player. And then Sean, was it Sean Young? No, not Sean Young. As the girl. What was her name? No, Phoebe Cates. Phoebe Cates. That's it. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, the names that came out of this movie, you know, the superstars that were in that film.
And then and then the teachers too, you know, Vincent Schiavelli.
Yep.
And Mr. Hand. Oh God.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. Blanking moment here. How am I not remembering Mr. Hand?
Mr. Hand. He had a TV series called My Favorite Martian back in the 60s. And you see, if my wife was in the room, she would like, you know, she'd nail it. She'd go, I said, thank you, honey. I appreciate that. You know, she literally, without her, I would be lost. I mean, literally, I'll sit there, I'll name off times and places and events and things, and she'll connect the names to everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah, she is absolutely the yin to my yang.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah. There was just so many great things to watch on cable TV back in those days. I call them, you know, the cable TV classics. Were just the 80s were just such a great time for those. And and of course then we had the raunchier ones like, you know, Porky's.
The ones we always tried to sneak into.
Yep. Revenge of the Nerds. And actually, if you look at Revenge of the Nerds, you know, I think they committed to today's standards. I think a lot of the stunts they pulled would probably be qualified as felonies nowadays.
Oh, I watched. The Caddyshack.
Caddyshack
came out in 1980. Uh-huh. The stuff that went on during Animal House and Caddyshack, the filming of those two movies, I heard. Yeah, those film sets would have been shut down just a couple of days into production, and they were literally writing. Ivan Reitman. What's his name? Who played? God, now I see he played Egon Spengler in the Ghostbusters.
Oh, Harold Ramis
was the writer for helped write Caddyshack with him and Dan Aykroyd. I think it was Dan Aykroyd, was it?
Yeah.
Yes, something like it. But Harold Ramis was the main writer on it. And I know for a fact that they were literally writing the script like as they were going along. And the country club, which I actually played golf at that country club right after they left. And the owner of the country club said to them, I don't want any special effects or any explosions on my golf course. So they saved it till the last day. They had all the equipment, they had everything packed up into the trucks. They blew it all up and they like hauled ass. That's the story that I was told happened. Now, how much truth there is and how much embellishment, but I did hear that they saved that shot for the last day. Yes, a lot of that final scene there, you could tell where there was actually special effects, like stuff was edited into it. Mm-hmm. But the one big original explosion, I heard that somebody called the fire department. They thought that a plane had crashed into the golf course because there was an airstrip there not far off. So when that explosion went off, they thought there was a plane crash. So all hell broke loose. Yeah, I don't think they get away with that stuff nowadays.
I don't think so either. But then, you know, and then that was another family of movies that came out, all the National Lampoon stuff, because then they did the vacation movies, and there was a number of other ones with those too. Such great times to grow up, I tell you, you know.
Absolutely.
Such great times to grow up and discover cable TV and such a wonderful era, you know.
It really was a great time.
It really was, you know. And then it was amazing to me too, because I can remember growing up in a time where, you know, they had movies on television, but there was commercials and the quality of the movies, it wasn't good. When you would watch, sometimes you would watch the movie of the week or a classic movie on television, the film quality wasn't good like it is now, you know. And I don't know if you agree with me on this, but when video stores first came out, you know, I went in and I had heard my mother and, you know, people talking about all these classic movies that were just timeless classics from over the years. And I went to the video store to rent them, you know, ones like The French Connection. Even like Godfather 1. This was probably in the late 80s. I was probably, you know, old enough to go have my own membership and get these. And I wanted to see these movies.
Sure.
And you'd watch them on cable and then you'd get video copies of them. And, you know, thank God for preservation and restoration.
Yeah.
Re-releasing these films with better quality, because I watched The Godfather on home video from Blockbuster or wherever I got
it. Yeah. Yeah.
VHS. The quality of the VHS, the sound and just the picture quality was so bad. I was like, what are people seeing this movie? And then I ended up seeing it on cable later after they had digitally remastered it.
Yep.
And you know, redid it. I mean, you agree that, you know, that had a lot to do with drawing new fans to these movies too.
Well, we just watched The Godfather actually about 2 weeks ago, and we sat down and we watched it on our OLED LG, whatever television that's just got amazing detail. And of course it's remastered, and you sit there and you go, oh my God, you notice things in the scenes that you never noticed when you watched it back in the day. But you know, that's the progression of filmmaking. I mean, everything is digital now. I prefer reel to reel. I love watching that cinematic quality. Mm-hmm. Is it the quality of, see, now people are focused more on, I want to see all the pores in the guy's skin on his face and or the woman's face. I want to see all that detail. And I want to see sort of a genre. You know, I want to see this. You know, when you watch movies like that, especially nowadays when you watch period pieces, they colorize it in such a way to make it seem more period. You know, if you watch Tombstone, it's got that, it's got almost that, that tinny look to it, just a hint of it. It's got great coloring, but it's also got, you know, lots of browns, lots of oranges, and it's just whatever, it's whatever the time period is, I think, can really sort of connect with the audience. And the Godfather movie has a specific time period. It's got a timestamp. So it's 70s.
Yes, it is.
It's 70s. And to get a really good vibe of what the 70s were and how it was, it's timeless, you know, it really is. Changing the quality of the film so that you can see the detailing is one thing, but the original cell, you know, on reel is just in and of, I mean, it's like listening to, I don't know, like listening to Led Zeppelin on vinyl or listening to it on your digital iPad or your digital music. It's totally different. The clarity is different. And, you know, but there's something about hearing that little in the background. There's something about hearing that, that connects with you. And maybe that's what you grew up on, you know, and to connect that with acting. That's what when I'm acting, I connect with smells. I connect with even tastes, and I connect with music. And those are the things that can get, if you're doing a period piece, if you're doing something in the 60s or the 70s or whatever, you know, there are certain smells and there's certain sounds when I hear them that connect me with that time period. And it helps me to connect with that character. So, you know, very important. I mean, these, even over the years, all those different kinds of films are important right in that era that they were made in. Yes, they are. They're a timestamp.
They really are. They really are. I remember watching Willy Wonka, the Gene Wilder version, and they had digitally remastered it. And I don't know if this was an unintended consequence, but it was almost like they remastered it too well, because in the very one of the earlier scenes when they're finally in the candy factory, the Augustus Gloop scene, if you know what I mean, where the kid falls into the chocolate river.
Yeah, I do.
You know, I remember walking around when they would show the shots where they're going around the room and they're eating the trees and, you know, eating the mushroom with the marshmallow in it. You really got a good look at the props and how they were made. And it also sort of, it almost looked like 3D. Almost, which really,
it almost looked cartoonish. It almost looked cartoonish. As well. And I heard rumors that, like, obviously 99% of that set was all plastic and wasn't real. I mean, and the little buttercup that Gene Wilder sipped out of and then bit into was like this awful wax, like some wax prop. And, you know, the same thing. And then, of course, the little whipped cream that was on the mushrooms and stuff like that. Most of it wasn't even edible. I can only imagine. I can only imagine what the chocolate river was made of, because I guarantee you it wasn't chocolate.
To
have to fall into that and swim into that, and you know, just the smell of it and everything. But hey, that was what was called Technicolor back then in the day.
And yes, it was.
That's a totally different kind of color. And so the brightness of the colors today would be completely different doing it through the digital coloring and through the, you know, through the lenses of the digital cameras. You're getting a different type of color, and hence when you get different lighting and different coloring, you're getting a different vibe. Amazing.
It really is. And I'm glad that they have been able to restore a lot of these, because again, you were saying before, you know, the look of the film, but then also too, there were times when even the audio is better, because there were times when I was watching it and it, the older versions on the old VHS tapes, and I couldn't understand what was being said sometimes. And then this even made it more pleasing in an audible way where you can understand and you can hear everything even better.
Yeah, well, understand this, Mike. You were probably the 5,000th listener of that videotape, and that cassette wears down after, you know, how many plays.
That could be that could be part of it, too.
You know? Yeah, but that was also, oh, God, it was really funny. I mean, you'd sit there and you'd throw the video in, mm-hmm. and you go, okay, am I going to get one that was chewed up? Am I going to have to go back?
right.
But, you know, a couple of times we rented movies, and yeah, we get mm-hmm. 10 minutes into it, and all of a sudden it'd go, and it got chewed up in somebody's machine, and they, you know, wound it and fixed it and mm-hmm. brought it back mm-hmm. to the store and kind of like didn't say anything. But yeah, I mean, those videos got rented hundreds and hundreds of times, and you know, there's only so much that magnetic imaging on the tape. You know, they get worn out sooner
they
or
do.
Later. And
then they do.
The quality slowly gets, you know, diminished. So
right. And speaking of which, too, that was also the era of the classic MTV concerts and the classic HBO and Showtime comedy specials.
Oh yeah.
And you want to talk about some tapes wearing out. You know, we used to record all of those, and I had a hell of a music library for concerts that we used to record off of MTV. And
great stuff.
The comedy specials that were on HBO, the One Night Stands and the Rodney Dangerfield Young Comedian specials.
Oh, my gosh.
We wore those tapes out to where they were unwatchable.
Yeah. Well, you know, as an actor, you watched all these great iconic, you mm-hmm. know, the Richard Pryors. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I've watched the Eddie Murphy's Raw, you know,
I know.
That probably was one of my favorite stand-ups at Eddie Murphy Raw. I burned that tape out. It was, mm-hmm. You know, and it was great. I mean, we're here today because of those guys.
You remember Carlin at Carnegie?
Oh God, George Carlin.
Yeah.
I wish I could be that good. Mm-hmm. I wish I could be that. My wife told me, she says, I think you should do some stand-up. And I said, I would probably try too hard to be like another comedian rather than mm-hmm. do my own. I says, these guys have been working for, you know, 20, 30 years. I mean, Sebastian Maniscalco, he started out, he's been doing it for like 20, 30 years.
Oh, easily. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And back then in the day, you know, people weren't packing the house for him. You take that kind of, you have to take that many years to sharpen and hone and tweak every little nuance about you.
Mm-hmm.
And my son, my 19-year-old is into Sebastian Maniscalco now.
Oh, I love him. I love him.
He watches him on his phone and I look at him and I will sit there and I'll say, you see that little kick move he just did right there? That's hours of rehearsal, mm-hmm. hours and hours and hours of getting it wrong and getting it wrong. I said, every little nuance of every move that he makes has been carefully honed over the last 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I said, Bill Burr, same guy, same thing. I mean, mm-hmm. You watch his early stuff and then you watch his stuff today. That's what I like watching. I like watching these guys when they're young. Mm-hmm. Seinfeld, when he first came out, even Jay Leno, when he first came out, you sit there and you go, ooh, these guys they're raw. And then you see 10 years later and you go, wow, perfection.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know, and that's it. It doesn't happen overnight. Mm-mm. So I told my wife, I said, if I jumped into stand up right now, I said, I wouldn't hit my stride till I'm 70.
Right, yeah, that's the truth. That's the truth. I have a comedic musical act that I do, but and I don't really do it as much anymore because I'm tied up a little more with, you know, acting.
Yeah.
But, it takes a good while to be able to really come out with good songs and good material to really perfect your act and master your instrument. It's really not something, I mean, there are some people that are very good right off the bat, but, you know, seasoning and polishing.
Well, and it's also failure, trial and error.
You know? Sure is.
When I was doing the Ghostbuster show, we were on a script, mm-hmm. but it had gotten to the point where, as the actor, the script became so rote, it became so just almost mechanical that we started inventing all these little nuances to the character that we would bring to the character. We would run it by our performance coach before we would get out on stage, and they would be like, that's go for it, man, do it. That's great stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And you find and you create something different and still stay within the script and stay within the character. But stuff that kept it fresh for you, because as an actor, there's nothing worse as an actor than getting bored with your character. Because once mm-hmm. you're bored with your character, it's time to move on and do another project.
Yeah, so. You're right. You're right. I agree with you. There were times in my murder mystery company where we change up the jokes that we do. And sometimes we add things to different scenes. It's all improv. And we have a storyline, but it's not word for word scripted. Yeah. And there's been times when we've changed up gags, or we've thought of something, or we've tried something like at the spur of the moment to keep things fresh.
Yep.
But the thing that's funny too, is that when we do our shows, and I'll just give you a quick example. When we work trains, there's usually four cars that we do. So the murder mystery show has five characters. Yep. There's a cop who's like the narrator who goes in and out all the time. Okay.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, character one with character two, you know, car one, car two, car three, car four. And then when they come back, you know, character one with character three, boom, 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 boom. Yeah. And the thing is, that's really funny, is that there have been jokes that we've added, or jokes that we've come up with, where we go to car one, everybody hits the deck. Car two, everybody hits the deck. Car three, everybody hates it.
Yeah.
Car four, everybody loves it again. So sometimes it's unpredictable as to how things are going to go over, or who they're going to go over with.
Yeah.
Or sometimes there's just no reason, or sometimes it could be you said it slightly differently, or something like that. Or sometimes somebody just didn't think it was funny, you know, but there's always,
it's different audience in there every room, different audience every night. I mean, you know what? I've done shows where we've killed it, and then I've done shows where they've killed us. And so it's, you know, it just depends on it's your responsibility as the actor to bring the energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the energy cannot lift the audience, then you just have to keep bringing the energy and maintain it. And it's on them if they're not having a good time. I mean, you know, they could have gotten into, they couldn't, maybe the husband and wife couldn't find a babysitter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had some struggles during the day or the week, or job people, any number of things could make an audience member not really be in the mood to be there. Mm-hmm. So, but again, as a performer, you've always got to bring your A game too.
And oh yeah.
But some nights are off. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's happened. I mean, you know, doing, what is it? I did Chekhov in college, Three Sisters. Oh my gosh. And you can only do the Three Sisters and be excited about it so many times before it you know, it's a struggle. Period mm-hmm. pieces are very difficult because the audience is, you know, they're going to struggle unless they really know, and they're really into Shakespeare, they're really into Chekhov, or, you know, any of these old playwrights, they're going to struggle to understand. They're going to mm-hmm. struggle to, you know, there's always going to be somebody that's bringing a date that doesn't want to be there, you mm-hmm. know? Or there's always a husband that's going there because his wife loves Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just like the opera. It's just like, you know, the ballet. It's like anything else. You've got to maintain that energy. And, you know, that goes for anything. TV series, you know, you may not have an audience, but still, you know, my favorite all-time TV show is the Carol Burnett Show.
Oh yeah. No, that's great stuff. That's great stuff.
I mean, it's not just, it's comedy gold because they went off script so many times. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't tell you how many times Tim Conway and Harvey Korman had competitions to see who could make the other guy screw up. Mm-hmm. They really did. And 9 times out of 10, Tim Conway always got the best of Harvey.
Yes, he did.
There were a couple of times Harvey just nailed Tim. Mm-hmm. And those are the golden moments. I mean, those are the greatest moments on television mm-hmm. ever. And boy, I wish they tried to bring back some of that stuff. I mean, you know, they tried to bring back, that improv show with Wayne Brady.
Oh, whose line is it anyway?
Whose line is it anyway? Yeah,
Drew Carey and those guys. Yeah.
I actually was working at Universal Studios in Orlando when Wayne Brady was working there too.
Is that right?
He was doing the Monster Show is what it was called. It was a big monster review show where all the monsters came out and they did all these singing and dancing numbers. And I also knew Cheryl Hines was also working at Universal at the time as well.
Oh, okay. And
from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah. She's something else too. She's really good.
She went through her growing period too. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. she did what she was is she played the hostess for Nickelodeon shows for the live studio audience. And then when she came out here to California, she immersed herself into the Groundlings, really worked hard and honed her craft, and it paid off.
Right.
You know, she was in the right place at the right time. She was very fortunate to get that role. I mean, so many other people out there would have killed for it, but you know, she nailed it. She nailed the timing. And when it was her opportunity, she was prepared and she nailed it and hit it out of the park.
Oh yeah.
That was great for her. That was great for her. So
you can never say too little about training and classes. They always say, you know, when it comes to acting, it's ABC, always be in a class.
Yep.
Always be in a class. And it's it's been a little bit of a challenge with pandemic, because I used to spend some of my, you know, the money I made doing murder mystery to be able to afford to take the classes. But, you know, I've done some of it, you know, not as much as I would have hoped to, this year, the pandemic and everything, but, you got to keep yourself fresh, and it's always good to have, you know, somebody to bounce something off of. And, you know, have
sure your wife has been a, I'm sure your wife has been a nice sounding board, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And vice versa. You guys have probably shared mm-hmm. stuff with each other to keep yourselves, you know, focused and it is.
We sure have. And the thing is, you know, when we're doing our, you know, I guess, you know, cause all the auditioning has been from home this year. We direct each other and we, you know, kind of, you know, look at each take and everything. And we say, you know, try this, try that, you know, kind of direct each other. And, it works pretty well. It works pretty well. It's a, it's good to have. And well, the other thing too, when it comes to, you know, being with somebody and being in this business, you got to be with somebody that gets it, because if you're with somebody that doesn't get it, somebody that doesn't understand everything that goes into it, is your life can be hell.
Well, your marriage wouldn't work.
I'm
blessed. My wife, when I met my wife, we were both studio guides.
Oh, okay.
Because I was actually, when I actually first got hired at Universal Studios, they hired me as a studio guide. And then a few months later, I auditioned and was booking the shows there, but that's where we met. And she was, you know, she was always had an acting bug herself, and she's been very supportive of my career, and, you know, God bless her. She's the best thing that ever happened to me. Cause I'll tell you, I'd probably be in a ditch somewhere, you know, passed out, you know, homeless or whatever, because she has supported me and she's kept my fire fueled, in more ways than one. And, you know, we're lucky to have, wives that look at you that way, that see you know, and see where you're heading and support that direction.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, because I have been in relationships with women before that, didn't get it. They didn't like it, and it didn't last because you know, they didn't like me, because truthfully, you know, my background, I've got a much bigger background in playing in bands and music than I do really in acting, but, they didn't like it. You know, when I was playing out, they didn't like it. You know, they would complain, when are you coming home? When, you know, why do you have to play so much? You know, why? You know? And you know, if they don't understand it, because the thing is that with somebody like us, we don't do it because we want to do it. We do it because it's in our blood and we have to do it, because if we don't, then we're not going to have anything in life, you know?
Yeah. I've had dozens of jobs over the years. Mm-hmm. You know, when I moved out here to California, first off, the actor strike happened and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't do any auditions. I couldn't perform for a year. Mm-hmm. They were literally shut down for a year. Mm-hmm. And then the writer strike was right after that. So things were tough and I had to find, I did everything from, I worked in a flower shop. I delivered pizzas. Mm-hmm. I worked for a painting company. I worked construction. I mean, you just have to be a jack of all trades and be ready to do that kind of work. and be humble to do that kind of work. Because, you know, like I said earlier, acting is a part-time job.
It really is.
You know, it's especially if you're an actor, and it doesn't matter how much you get paid. If you do a million, if you do a film and you net $1 million out of that film, you're still an unemployed actor. You know, you might be a rich unemployed actor, but you're still an unemployed actor.
Right.
And you and I both know that as an actor, when I'm done with my project, when I'm done filming something and it's wrapped, I go home and the next day I'm suffering from withdrawal. I'm like, I got to get out there. I got to get another project.
Oh,
I
got
to work. It's food for my soul. Literally is. And a lot of people don't realize that.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, when I left, you know, when I finished Gotham, I finished Kimmy Schmidt. And even the, you know, even it was only a 1 day shoot for the Viking and the Viking commercial. But, you know, when I left there, I was just like, okay, God, I got to get another one. I was driving home from Connecticut and I was like, geez, I got to get another one. I got to get another one. You know,
it's a drug, man. Coming, it is. You know? It's, you know, for the actors that have it in them, in their soul, it's a drug and it feeds that soul. And then when you're done filming, it's like it starts to taper off and it starts, and then you've got to have something else. And if you don't, you better find yourself busy with something. You better stay busy with something. Cause it can be depressing. You know, I've had many bouts over my career with, you know, temporary depression, because you sit there and you go, wow, it's been months since I've had a project. This year has been a tough year. If it hadn't been for my wife also got laid off from her job. She was a new home sales rep. And so she got furloughed from her job.
Right.
And so the two of us living together for the last, you know, 10 months, you really get to know your spouse when you're waking up every day and you're doing everything together, because, you know, there's nothing. And finally now things are starting to open up and, you know, we're both starting to work our way back to work.
Yep.
But, you know, it can be depressing for both people.
It can. And the thing is, no matter what you accomplish and no matter all the great things that you've done in the past, you know, unless you get something else, you doubt yourself. You doubt yourself. Yeah. And that is just the worst thing ever. Just having doubts about yourself, and you lose confidence in yourself.
Yeah.
And it's very, very difficult. Very, very difficult to deal with sometimes for some people. You know, so, well, Timothy, I've had a hell of a great time talking to you today.
It's been a
great conversation here. This is the time of the show. This is called the beyond shameless part of the show. I don't really have an official title for it, but you can shamelessly plug anything that you would like to shamelessly plug, as shameless as you would like to be, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah. Shamelessly plug, shameless. Yes. Well, listen, you guys, whoever your listeners are, if you want to give me a follow, I usually do all of my stuff on Instagram. So you can find me on Instagram at the Timothy Mac. And you can follow me. I usually follow everybody back that follows me. I don't really have a preference to that. And then you can find me on IMDb. Just type in imdb.me/Timothy McLaughlin. And you can see projects I'm working on, stuff that I've done in the past. And if you'd like to pop back over to Instagram and ask me a question or send me a message, say, hey, what was it like, you know, working on this show, or what was it like working on that show? Yeah, I'll answer you back. I'm not one of those. I'm not too big where I'll sit there and throw out a statement and, you know, people ask me questions, I won't reply. I'm usually good at that. And those are usually my two media platforms. I am on Facebook. I don't go on it as much as I used to. And you can find me there. I think it's just Timothy McLaughlin on Facebook. Just look for the photo, because I think I have pretty much the same picture on all of my sites. And keep your eyes out for my projects that I'm doing. I did sign a couple months ago. I signed with a modeling commercial agent called Brand Models and Talent, and they're an international agency out of Irvine. So if you wanted to look at more of my headshots, I got some other model pictures over there called Brand Models and Talent, but still working on the theatrical agent. So Mm-hmm. Anybody out there that has one or wants me to meet with one, just let me know.
Okay.
That's all great. Good.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I've had a really, like I said, a really enjoyable time talking to you, and I've loved listening to your stories and everything tonight. It's just been a great time. So cool. Thank you for being with us on Foul Players Radio. And thank you for listening, folks. This has been Timothy McLaughlin, and we will see you next time. Thanks again, Timothy.
Hey, no problem. Great talking to you, Mike.
Howdy. It's Matt Gwynn here, popping in to let you know about the adventures of the albino rhino. It's a show, Frank the Giraffe here, my co-host, James Godwin, and myself put on for you guys twice a week. Every Wednesday, we talk to a comedian, and every Friday, we call it Freak Yeah Friday. The show itself is not safe for work, and that freak is definitely a different word. I just don't know what podcast you're going to be listening to this promo on, and I don't want to, start screaming explicatives while you're sitting in your office, if you're lucky enough to have been able to go back to the work that you did before inside of an office or whatever, you know? But we go on an adventure twice a week, and it's a good time because we get to sit down and talk to some really cool people. And I enjoy it because, you know, I'm just curious little albino who likes to get to know folks, you know? You can find us a couple ways, actually multiple ways, really. Man, there's a lot of different ways to find us. You can find us through our central hub, which is www.albinorhino.me. It's the website. Find me on. And then, you know, the podcast, you can find the videos on YouTube. Search for Adventures of the Albino Rhino. Also linkable from our website. And you can also find us through Anchor, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Radio Public, and Spotify. That's right. We're on the same place Joe Rogan is. Granted, we're not the Joe Rogan Experience, but you know what I mean? We're there. So give us a listen. Promise you won't be dissatisfied. And enjoy your day.
What is going on, minions? Mike here for Misery Point Radio, and you're listening to the Coast to Coast Power Hour on the SJ Network. Now, I know what you're thinking. Mike, what the F is a Coast to Coast Power Hour? Well, my uneducated and uninformed friend, the Coast to Coast Power Hour is a Borg-like collective of epic podcasters from epic podcasts that have all come together to discuss the important things in life. Pop culture, current events, random awesomeness, stuff like that. Trust me, you need this in your life. For more information on this show and all the shows on the Coast to Coast Power Hour, as well as on the SJ Network, reach out to publicist Steve Joyner at www.s-j-network.com or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. No need to thank me. I'm just out here, you know, changing lives.
What's Your Effin' Binge is a podcast brought to you by Chris, Anchor, and Spotify. And what we talk to our guests about is what they're currently binge-watching on TV. And what we do is we like to take a different approach. I don't want to know what the name of the show is that they're going to talk about before they come on. I have to actually guess it. So I ask them who, what, when, where, why, and try to figure out what it is that they're watching. A lot of times I'm able to guess it, and sometimes I'm not. And that's fine. That adds to the comedy of the show. We like to bring our guest on, whether they're a model or an actress or producer or musician, and just let them have a platform to be able to tell everybody what they have coming up next, and also entertain everybody with what's worth watching. So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of What's Your Effin' Binge. Thanks. It's Chris.